recipients. As the sunrise prayer service ended, Tursunov paid his bill and stepped outside to have a cigarette. As he lit the Gauloise, he leaned against the building and watched as the mosque emptied out. There weren't many attendees, 20 at most. As the men reached the sidewalk, some lingered, but most said their goodbyes and were on their way. There were still no signs of any surveillance that he could detect. Tursunov watched as the last of the men exited the small storefront. He was concerned that Eunice might have chosen to skip prayers that morning. Then he finally saw him in the doorway. He and two other men were saying goodbye to an older man with a thick gray beard who must have been the imam. The Tajik was struck by how much Eunice looked like his father. Tall, the same intelligent eyes, the same broad nose. The resemblance was uncanny. The photo Abdul provided hadn't done him justice. Eunice and the two other young men embraced the imam, stepped onto the pavement, and went their separate ways. Tursunov pretended not to be paying attention and continued to smoke his cigarette. He wanted to give any surveillance the opportunity to fall in behind the young chemist. Once he felt he had allowed enough time, he flicked his butt into the street and headed off in the same direction. He was careful to stay back and on the opposite side of the street. He didn't want to crowd anyone. Two blocks away from the mosque, he was beginning to feel confident that the chemist wasn't being followed. But then, a figure appeared from around the corner. It was a man. He was dark-skinned and dressed like many of the men he had seen in Aubervilliers. On the surface, there was nothing to suggest anything out of the ordinary. There was something about him, though, that radiated police. He could sense it, even though the man was so far up ahead of him. Eunice must have sensed it as well, because at one point, he turned around and looked back. Shortly thereafter, the dark-skinned man turned the corner and broke off. A block later, he was replaced by another cop. The chemist was definitely under surveillance. That complicated things enormously. The Tajik had to assume that in addition to following the young man, the French authorities were also listening in on his calls and reading his emails. They might have even bugged his apartment. The big question was, why? What had Eunice done to draw such attention? Abdul claimed that he was clean, that he had not been involved with plotting any sort of jihadism. Was he correct? Tursunov wondered if the answer might lie with the second cop on the surveillance team. He was lighter-skinned, with longer hair and a goatee. He could have passed for an Arab, but there was something else about him, something that gave Tursunov pause. Making a right at the next corner, he broke off his pursuit and doubled back toward the metro. He would wait until it was dark and come back then. Chapter 35. Libya. The cluster of sand-colored one-story buildings was just off the road. They were abandoned and in an advanced state of disrepair. In multiple places, the 3-foot-high stone wall surrounding the property had crumbled. Harvath, Barton, Stalin, and Morrison hopped out of the truck to quickly clear the structures. Once they were confident no one was there, they helped Gage climb out and directed Haney around back. A thatched roof over a long-covered patio had partially collapsed. Moving some of the refuse beneath it, they were able to make enough room to park the technical. Then they rapidly piled up garbage around it. It wasn't the perfect camouflage job, but considering the circumstances, it would have to do. Of the three buildings, the one to the north was the most secure. It had the thickest walls and an interior access to the roof. After hustling the weapons and ammunition in from the truck, Harvath grabbed a length of tattered blue tarp from the pile of junk and climbed up to the roof. It was flat and surrounded by a low parapet. In several places, pieces were missing. Whether that was by design or through neglect, the holes provided good spots for him to observe the road without being seen. Crawling over to one, he raised a small pair of binoculars and peered out. There were no signs of any approaching vehicles. Over his shoulder, The sun had cleared the horizon and was beginning its slow crawl into the morning sky. Activating his satellite phone, he extended its antenna and waited impatiently for it to acquire a signal. Once it did, he sent a text back to Langley with his exact GPS coordinates. Next, he punctured the blue plastic tarp with his knife and cut it in half lengthwise. Then, using pieces of concrete block to hold it down, he fashioned a large blue plus sign in the center of the roof. Between that and the GPS coordinates, the drone should be able to pinpoint their location. They had risked a tremendous amount in snatching the smuggler. If he didn't help them connect any dots regarding the drowned chemistry student and the impending attacks, Harvath was going to put a bullet right between his eyes. Hearing something behind him, he turned to see Haney with the remaining rocket and RPG launcher. "Everything good downstairs?" he asked. The Marine nodded as he set the gear down and joined him. "Gage is stable. Stalin tried to give him something for the pain, but Gage told him to fuck off. Says he can't fight if he's high." Harvath smiled. "Halim is also stable," Haney continued, "but in a lot of pain. Gage told him to fuck off, too." Harvath smiled again. "What about Barton and Morrison?" "I've got Barton on the roof of the south building. Morrison is inside the one in the middle. In addition to their own weapons, they each took an AK and extra ammo." No matter what needed doing, Haney was always on top of it. He was about to thank him when his satellite phone vibrated. It was a text from Langley. "What's up?" Haney asked. "Remember the Glocks the militia members were carrying at the electronics shop?" The Marine nodded. "I emailed the serial numbers to the agency. DOD finally tracked the paperwork down. They were stolen from Camp 27.
"The Special Forces training base outside Tripoli?"
"Yep," said Harvath. "The one that got looted."
"Uncle Sam doesn't like it when you steal from him."
"No, he doesn't. In fact, he gets very..."
Harvath was suddenly quiet. Picking the binoculars back up, he looked out through the hole in the parapet again. A multi-vehicle convoy was headed their way from Zelton. Keying up his radio, he notified the team. Before he could tell Haney to head back downstairs, the Marine was already on his way. Raising Strike Force 2's drone team on the USS George H.W. Bush, he updated them and asked,
"What's the ETA on that Reaper?"
"There's been some complication with the handoff."
"We need that drone ASAP," Harvath replied.
"We're working on it. Stand by."
He wanted to tell them to hurry the hell up. Instead, he confirmed the transmission and told his team,
"Weapons hot, but nobody shoots. Only if we absolutely have to."
They all hoped that the militia would just pass right by, but that wasn't the kind of day they'd been having. The prior drone team had counted 15 vehicles vectoring in on them. If there were 4 men in each, that could mean up to 60 fighters, maybe more. As the column got closer, Harvath counted 10 vehicles. Half of them were technicals. Of those, 2 were mounted with the massive anti-aircraft guns he'd been warned about. It looked like the convoy from Abu Kamash had linked up with the convoy pursuing them out of the south.
"Keep going,"
Harvath said to himself, nodding his head down the road.
"Nothing to see here."
As the convoy rolled closer to their location, every muscle in his body tensed and adrenaline coursed through his veins. He was like a coiled snake, ready to strike. Taking a deep breath, he willed himself to relax. Slowly, he got his heart rate under control. The SEAL mantra, "Slow is smooth and smooth is fast," popped up from somewhere deep in his mind.
"Be calm. Don't rush,"
he reminded himself as he began to depress the trigger of his M4. Near the entrance of the derelict compound, the convoy slowed. Fighters in the lead vehicle seemed to be trying to decide whether it was worth their time to check it out. He could see the anti-aircraft guns clearly now. If they were turned on the compound, they'd chew through it like a fat man going through a box of Thin Mints. The militia must have decided the buildings weren't worth it as they picked up speed once again and proceeded past. Harvath kept his finger on his trigger and followed the convoy with the suppressor on the end of his rifle. He didn't even take a breath until the last vehicle had gone by. Once it had driven down the road, he radioed his team and said, "We're clear." A feeling of relief washed over him as he set his rifle down and unkinked his neck. For a moment, he allowed his eyes to close. He was beginning to think that they just might make it out of this after all. Then he heard Barton's voice over the radio.
"Second convoy inbound," the SEAL said.
Opening his eyes, Harvath snatched up his rifle and looked. He already knew how many vehicles there'd be. He didn't need to count. Based on the math, this had to be the remaining five, including two technicals. As they neared, he saw that he was right. It wasn't much consolation. The moment they pulled even with the compound, the two technicals came to a stop on either side of the entrance, turned on an angle to block traffic, and took up firing positions. The other three vehicles were SUVs. One stayed outside the compound, a little farther down the road, while the other two slowly rolled inside and stopped. They were here to search the property. Fuck. Harvath took a deep breath, exhaled slowly, and began applying pressure to his trigger once again. Chapter 36. The militia members didn't seem keen to get out of their SUVs. Rolling their windows down, they pointed their guns out and waited. They were so close and the desert so quiet that he could hear them whispering to each other in Arabic. Finally, one door opened, then another. Out on the road, fighters had already climbed into the beds of the technicals, chambered the heavy machine guns, and pointed them at the buildings. Harvath focused on the closest technical to him. Barton would take the other. Haney, Stalin, and Morrison would handle the men on the ground inside the compound. There was still time for them to get back inside their vehicles and drive away. He knew, though, that they wouldn't. There were eight of them. Slowly, they began to walk away from the SUVs and toward the buildings. That's when Haney gave the command to light them up. As soon as they heard the word "now" over the radio, the entire team began firing. Harvath dropped the machine gunner first, and then locked in on the ammo feeder standing in the truck bed next to him. He caught the man in the lower back as he was diving out, and then lost sight of him. Adjusting his rifle, he turned his attention to the windshield of the technical and pumped the cab full of hot lead. Both the driver and passenger had been trying to get out and now fell to the ground dead. When the ammo feeder popped his head up at the rear of the vehicle, Harvath was ready for him. Pressing the trigger of his M4, he sent a round through his skull just above his left eyebrow. There was a spray of blood across the tailgate as the man fell dead. Sweeping his rifle toward the other technical, he saw Barton had already taken out its crew and had focused on a new target. Out on the road, the remaining SUV was trying to make a run for it. Harvath added his rifle to the fight, sending round after round into the vehicle. From downstairs, a round from Gage's M4 ripped through the air and entered the rear passenger side window, tearing through the back of the driver's head. The fighter was killed instantly. With no one controlling it, the SUV caught its tire as it veered off the side of the road and flipped over. A fraction of a second later, Gage could be heard on the radio. "Enjoy the virgins, you assholes!" Harvath and Barton remained on their rooftops to provide overwatch, while Haney and Morrison patrolled out to the road to make sure there were no survivors. They had checked the bodies around both technicals and were halfway to the overturned SUV when Harvath thought he noticed something in the distance. Raising the binoculars, he saw a string of militia vehicles coming back from the other direction. And even at this distance, he could tell that two of them were the technicals with the anti-aircraft guns mounted in back. The fleeing militiamen must have raised the alarm before Gage shot their driver and their SUV flipped. Grabbing the RPG, he radioed for Haney and Morrison to get back to the compound as fast as they could. His next transmission was to the USS George H.W. Bush.
"Where the hell is my drone?"
10 minutes out," a voice responded. "Max."
"There's a convoy of technicals headed right at us. two with ZU-2 anti-aircraft guns. This is going to be over in less than 5 if you don't get that drone here now.
Ending the transmission, Harvath had a decision to make. The RPG-7 had a maximum effective range of 500 meters, but that was for stationary targets. If the target was moving, the range was cut down to 300 meters. Once he fired, they'd know exactly where he was and where to shoot. Looking at the militia vehicles down in the compound and shot up out on the road, he came up with a plan. It wasn't a great plan, but given how rapidly things were deteriorating, it was the best he had. As Morrison and Haney came running back, Harvath had them stop at the bullet-ridden technicals only long enough to grab what they needed. Barton leapt down from his roof and helped Stalin secure Halim in the bigger of the two SUVs. Morrison hopped into the smaller one and fired it up. Haney then brought their technical out of hiding and parked it alongside the rear of the far building. When everyone was loaded, Harvath didn't waste any time.
"Let's go," he shouted, pounding on the sides of both SUVs. "Move, move, move."
The vehicles sped out of the compound. Out on the road, they swerved around the perforated technical and headed in the opposite direction of the approaching column. Back in the compound, Harvath and Haney took up their positions and readied their weapons. They were the leave-behind force. No matter what the militia decided to do, it was their job to wreak as much havoc on the convoy as possible. Shouldering his RPG, Harvath looked over at Haney. The Marine, who had pulled an RPG from one of the technicals out front, was doing the same. He flashed Harvath the thumbs up and then, over the radio, said,
"Gage told me to tell you double or nothing you missed this shot."
Harvath just shook his head. Normally, he was full of smart-ass rejoinders. Not now, though. His body was beat to shit from jumping out of the Land Cruiser. He'd spiked his adrenaline multiple times over the last 18 hours. And he and Haney were severely outnumbered by an approaching force. He was saving all of his energy for the ass-kicking they were about to unleash. As the convoy neared the compound, Harvath signaled Haney. Everything was going to be decided by what happened in the next 30 seconds. Chapter 37. The column slowed as it approached. Then it came to a complete stop. The militia members could see the technicals blocking the road, the overturned SUV, and the corpses of their compatriots, all covered with bullet holes. If they were paying attention, they would also notice that two vehicles were missing. It was decision time. The compound was quiet. The only things moving were the flies on the dead bodies. A militia commander rolled down his window and lifted a pair of binoculars to get a better look. With the right rifle, Harvath probably would have been able to take him out, but his focus wasn't the militia's command structure. He wanted to knock out their technicals, first and foremost the two with the anti-aircraft guns. Something easier said than done. To their credit, these guys weren't stupid. There was plenty of spacing among all 10 of their vehicles. They weren't bunched up on the road, bumper to bumper, unable to maneuver if they had to. Two technicals with 50-cal machine guns were near the front, and another was in the middle. The technicals with the anti-aircraft guns were all the way at the back. By coming to a halt, the convoy was now in RPG range, but just barely. Harvath wanted them closer. He wanted to stack the deck as much as he could in his favor. So they continued to wait, while the Libya Liberation Front tried to make up its mind. What he had hoped for was that upon seeing the missing vehicles, the entire column would give chase. As they drove by, he and Haney would then pick them off one by one, focusing on the two key technicals. The second best option was that they divided their forces, sending some to give chase and the others to inspect the compound. What they were doing now, though, was nothing. They were just sitting there. Harvath could feel a headache coming on. He was hungry and caffeine deficient. He would have killed for a cup of coffee or an energy drink.
"Okay, fellas, what's it gonna be?" he said, as he watched the militia members. "Are we going to fight, or just stand around pulling each other's dicks?"
At that moment,
The commander got out of his truck and started shouting orders. Up and down the line, militia members began getting out of their vehicles. Haney looked at Harvath, who shrugged in response, before turning his attention back to the convoy. He had no idea what they were up to. A group began to amass near the vehicles in the middle. They were armed predominantly with AK-47s, but some had M4s. Harvath didn't need to guess where those had come from. When he saw other men begin to hop into the beds of the technicals, he knew they were in trouble. The militia was going to send a team in on foot to check the compound, while the rest of them, along with their vehicles, hung back. The technicals would provide overwatch for them.
"This isn't good," Haney said over the radio.
No, it wasn't, but they were going to have to deal with it.
"It looks like they're going to send in about 20 guys," replied Harvath. "That's nearly half their force. As soon as they're closer to us than they are to them, we let them have it."
Haney gave him the thumbs up and got ready. This was their ambush, and while the militia members might not be fully cooperating by driving straight into it, they still had surprise, speed, and violence of action on their side. Harvath planned to leverage that to the hilt. Within moments of being assembled, the assault force started moving. But much to Harvath's chagrin, they weren't moving alone. One of the technicals was moving with them.
Damn it.
Harvath had to think fast. The moment he and Haney fired their rockets, that machine gun was going to rain a world of hurt down on them. And the closer it was to their position, the more accurate its fire was going to be. They needed to find a way to take it out at the same time they took out the anti-aircraft guns. There had to be something. Harvath racked his brain, but he couldn't come up with anything. The anti-aircraft guns had to be taken out first. If they began firing on their position, it was game over. The technical creeping up on them would just have to come second, an extremely dangerous second. The assault force moved rapidly. If the compound was as empty as it looked, they needed to clear it and get back on the road. With every minute that passed, their quarry was getting farther away. He watched as the Libyans came down the road, getting closer and closer with each passing second. There was a withered crop of shrubs that he had decided on for his marker. Once they had reached that, it would be time to engage. Perspiration ran down the back of his neck. His palms were slick with sweat. He rubbed them on his chest to dry them before readjusting his hands on the launcher. All the while, he never took his eyes off the fighters converging on the compound. Eventually, he went from measuring the distance to the marker in meters to feet.
"Get ready," he said over the radio. "Almost there."
The technical passed the shrubs first, followed by the militiamen who were on foot. As soon as the last one had reached the marker, Harvath said,
"Hit it!"
Simultaneously, he and Haney leaned out from behind the buildings they were using as cover, sighted in their targets, and fired their weapons. Chapter 38. Before he even knew if he had struck his anti-aircraft technical, Harvath retreated back behind the building, dropped his empty launcher, and began running toward the other corner. As he did, he transitioned to his Russian grenade launcher. In one of the defeated technicals outside the compound, Morrison had found a handful of HEDP, high-explosive dual-purpose grenades. Used for both anti-tank and anti-personnel assaults, as long as you got them near a target, they were highly effective. He heard two explosions up on the road as the technical that was closing in on them then opened up with its 50 cal. The gunner strafed the part of the compound where he had seen the rockets fired from. The heavy rounds sent bits of rock and cinder block in all directions. Now at the opposite end of the main building, Harvath leaned out and let loose. He fired all three rounds in his launcher, re-racking it as fast as he could. And, more important, he did it before the gunner in the technical could swing the heavy 50 cal in his direction and cut him down. As he ducked back behind the building, he heard the rounds detonate. There was a massive explosion, followed by a roiling fireball that curled up into the sky. He had scored a direct hit. Slinging the launcher, he ran for the technical that Haney had parked behind the far building. Out on the road, the other heavy machine guns mounted in the beds of the militia pickup trucks began firing and chewing up the compound. The tailgate to Haney's pickup had been lowered, and Harvath leapt right into the back. Jumping up onto the top of the cab, he then grabbed the edge of the roof and pulled himself up.
"Haney!"
he yelled as he did.
"Don't shoot! It's me!"
The Marine reached down and helped him over the parapet.
"Give me a sit rep,"
he said, as he took a fraction of a second to catch his breath.
"You want the good news or the bad news?"
Haney asked. He had to raise his voice to be heard over the gunfire. Harvath signaled for him to get on with it.
"The good news is I hit my target. The bad news is you owe Gage $200.
"Damn it,"
Harvath replied.
"How many rockets do we have left?"
Haney pointed to the fully assembled RPG on the other side of the roof.
"Just the one."
Harvath patted his chest rig. He had 2 HEDP rounds left.
"What are you thinking?"
Harvath began to speak, but was interrupted by the anti-aircraft gun joining the fight. Even at a distance, it was ear-splitting. Its gunner was focused on the main building. The weapon's rounds tore through it like an angry child stabbing a gingerbread house with a screwdriver. With the anti-aircraft gun's maximum rate of fire of 600 rounds per minute, the structure wouldn't last long. It wouldn't take them long to work their way down to the building they were on, not to mention if one of them stood up and fired the RPG. They had to risk it, though.
"We've got to knock out that ZU-2,
Harvath insisted. Haney gestured to the weapon.
"Be my guest, but I don't want to be up on this rooftop when you do."
"How good are you with one of these?"
he asked, unslinging the Russian grenade launcher.
"Good enough to be dangerous."
Harvath handed it to him, along with the 2 rounds from his chest rig.
"I'll give you a head start. Whatever you do, make sure you take out both those other technicals."
"Roger that,"
Haney replied, as he loaded the weapon and picked up his M4. He stopped for a moment, put his hands on Harvath's shoulder, and then disappeared over the parapet. Staying as low as possible, Harvath moved to the opposite side of the roof. He examined the RPG and made sure everything was in order. Setting it down, he then risked a glance over the parapet. The technical he had taken out was a smoldering hulk, surrounded by bodies. Beyond it, the rest of the convoy was still in the same position. As the 50-cal machine guns sprayed the compound, the anti-aircraft gun stayed focused on hammering the main building. He had no idea why his first rocket hadn't taken it out, but it was his fault. He wasn't the kind of guy to blame his equipment. He owned the miss. This time, he would get it right. He had to. There wouldn't be another chance. If he didn't take out that technical, it'd be lights out for him and Haney. Being atop the southernmost building gave him a slight advantage for sighting in his target. It also meant he was farther away. His aim would have to be right on the money. Cocking the hammer, he raised the weapon and reminded himself to hold it firmly. Closing his left eye, he used his right eye to line up the RPG's front sight tip with the rear slide notch. The moment he launched, he was going to draw enemy fire. He reminded himself to keep his weapon aimed at the target. If he scrambled for cover too soon, it could result in another miss. Taking the weapon off safe, he double-checked his sight picture, exhaled, and began applying pressure to the trigger. There was no recoil with an RPG, but if he flinched or jerked the trigger in any way, that could also cause a miss. It seemed to take forever for the weapon to engage. Finally, he heard the loud bang and distinctive whoosh as the warhead erupted out of the launcher and went sizzling through the air toward its target. If the militia couldn't hear it over the gunfire, the gray-blue smoke trail headed right at them was unmistakable.
"Come on, baby,"
Harvath yelled.
"Come on!"
He watched as the rocket-propelled grenade sliced through the air at almost 300 meters a second. When it struck the anti-aircraft technical, it did so dead on. It was a perfect shot, followed by a spectacular explosion. Harvath began running before the 50-caliber machine guns from the two surviving technicals could be turned on his position. Reaching the far side of the roof, he leapt over the parapet and landed on the cab of the pickup below. Jumping down, he took off for Haney. Using a pile of rubble for cover, the Marine took aim at the first technical and fired the Russian grenade launcher. The round soared high into the air, landed right in the bed of the vehicle, and exploded. It wasn't until Haney was preparing to take out the last technical that Harvath saw the second wave of militia members closing in. The assault force this time was smaller. There were only six of them. They had used the withering fire from the technicals as cover and had flanked the compound. Haney didn't even know they were there until Harvath yelled, "Contact left! Contact left!" The Marine spun just as the final round left his grenade launcher. Dropping the weapon, he went for his rifle, but the Libyans had already begun shooting. Chapter 39. Before Haney could even get his gun in the fight, Harvath was firing in controlled pairs. He dropped one militiaman, then another.
"Get cover! Get cover!" he yelled at Haney.
Out on the road, the grenade landed short of the convoy and detonated. The remaining technical was unharmed. The Marine fell back behind the rubble, propped his rifle up, and began to return fire along with Harvath. Together, they took out four of the Libyans before the other two retreated behind the wall.
"Move right! Move right!"
Harvath shouted, trying to get Haney to the more secure cover of the middle structure. The Marine, though, was having trouble moving. Harvath looked down and saw his upper right thigh wet with blood. He'd been shot. Suddenly, the 50 cal opened fire on their position. Seconds later, the Libyans behind the wall joined in. Harvath and Haney were now taking fire from two directions. Any chance they had of making it to the middle structure was now gone. As soon as the militia realized they had them pinned down, they'd send in a team to hit them from behind or on their right flank and finish them off. That was if the 50 cal rounds didn't eat away their cover first. Poking his rifle out from around the rubble, Harvath fired at the two Libyans behind the wall. He pulled the tourniquet from his chest rig and tossed it to Haney.
"Get this wrapped around your leg, now!"
Then poking his rifle back out, he fired several more shots before focusing back on Haney.
"Have I mentioned how much I fucking hate Libya?" the Marine asked as he applied the nylon webbing around his upper thigh.
"You and me both,"
he replied, as he prepared to help cinch the tourniquet down.
"On three, okay?"
Haney nodded. Harvath tightened his grip, began the countdown, and then went early, pulling up as hard as he could on the word two. The Marine roared in pain. Harvath secured the tourniquet and then fired off several more rounds toward the wall.
"I don't want to fucking die here," Haney said through clenched teeth.
"Nobody's dying here,"
Harvath reassured him.
"Not on my..."
"Contact rear!"
the Marine yelled, raising his rifle and firing behind them. One of the Libyans had split off from his partner and had tried to get the drop on them. Haney shot the man several times in the chest until he slumped forward over the wall, dead. At the same moment, rounds from the 50 cal shattered the rubble just above their heads, showering them with pieces of rock.
"We can't stay here," said Harvath, as he swapped out his mag for a fresh one.
"Where are we supposed to go?"
Haney grunted, as he tried to reposition himself.
"Over the wall. We stay low on the other side. We can move in either direction."
"And then what?"
the Marine asked, as another barrage from the 50 cal pounded into the rubble pile and sent rocks tumbling down on top of them.
"Let's get ready to move. Can you put weight on that leg?"
Haney half stood, but when he tried to put weight on his right leg, the pain shot through his body like an electric shock, and the leg buckled.
"Fuck,"
he growled.
"That's okay," said Harvath. "We'll go with Plan B."
"What's Plan B?"
"We kill every last one of them."
The Marine shook his head.
"Negative. I'll cover you. You go for the wall."
"And let you have all the fun? Jesus, you Marines are greedy."
"I'm serious.
So am I, replied Harvath. We fight together, or we go over the wall together. I'm not leaving you here.
Don't be an asshole.
Shut up and get ready to fight. That's an order.
Haney did as he was told. Swapping magazines, he made ready. As he did, the hair suddenly stood up on the back of Harvath's neck. Whether it was something he heard or something he sensed, he knew they were in trouble.
RPG! He yelled. Get down!
The rocket crashed into the building just behind them and exploded, raining shrapnel and jagged pieces of cinder block on their position. Because Haney was unable to move quickly enough, Harvath had physically covered him and had taken the brunt of the fallout. But before he could even brush off the debris, the Libyans launched another rocket-propelled grenade. This one exploded even closer. A chunk of concrete hit Harvath's helmet so hard he saw stars.
We've got to make for that wall,
he yelled above the ringing in his ears as he tried to regain his vision.
It's no good here.
He would have given everything he owned for a single smoke grenade to mask their retreat to the wall. They didn't have one, though, and as far as Harvath could see, there was nothing he could use to create a diversion. He and Haney were going to have to fight their way out. Even though it had only been a matter of minutes, it felt like they had been in this battle for hours. The only break in fire from the Libyans' 50 cal came when they were reloading. At the rate they were going, Harvath half expected them to melt the barrel, but that was hoping against hope for a miracle. Judging the distance to the wall, he plotted the fastest course, and then, after filling Haney in, said,
When they stop to reload that 50, we haul ass. Copy?
Haney had serious doubts about Harvath getting them both across the open compound without getting shot. Nevertheless, the Marine nodded. Seconds later, the machine gun fell silent, and Harvath ordered,
Now!
Getting Haney up onto his left leg, Harvath folded him over his shoulders and took off with him in a fireman's carry. The Libyan behind the far section of wall popped up with his rifle and attempted to fire. But Haney was ready for him. His Beretta pistol was already in his hand. He fired 6 rounds, 2 of which found their mark, striking the man in the stomach and lower jaw. Out on the road, a handful of AK-47s erupted. The rounds popped and hissed all around them. Harvath, his leg muscles already burning, focused on the wall and pushed himself to move faster. Haney fired back. Weaving was out of the question. One wrong step while carrying his colleague, and he could have easily blown out a knee. They had barely made it a quarter of the distance when there was a loud pop from the convoy, and a blue-gray trail of smoke sped right at them.
RPG! Shouted Haney.
Harvath immediately changed course and ran for a different section of wall. He only made it 3 steps before the warhead hit. The force of the explosion threw both men to the ground. Harvath landed hard on his left side and once again saw stars. When his vision finally cleared, he saw Haney's pistol lying on the ground a few feet away. Beyond it, Haney was face down, not moving. Harvath began crawling in his direction. As he did, he called out, but the Marine didn't respond. Harvath crawled faster. Reaching him, he placed 2 fingers on his carotid artery and felt for his pulse. He was still alive. Supporting his neck, he was about to roll him over so he could drag him to safety when the Libyans opened up the 50 cal on them again. Harvath grabbed hold of the left shoulder strap on Haney's chest rig and pulled with all the strength he had. The heavy rounds tore up the ground and carved a path right toward them. As the gunner adjusted his aim, they got closer and closer. Harvath groaned as he doubled down and summoned every last ounce of energy he had. The wall looked like it was a mile away, but he refused to quit. The earth shook around him, and he prepared for the bullets that he knew were going to tear him up. Suddenly, there was a streak of orange in the sky. A fraction of a second later, there was an explosion, followed by another streak and another explosion. He looked over his shoulder toward the road, just as the team aboard the USS George H.W. Bush fired a 3rd Hellfire missile. the entire convoy was in flames. The Reaper had finally arrived back overhead. Their troubles, though, weren't over yet. Not by a long shot. Chapter 40. Northern Virginia. Every morning as Lydia Ryan drove to Reed Carlton's home, she reflected on what an insidious disease Alzheimer's was. After a lifetime spent in the espionage business, Carlton had amassed a wealth of experience. Every shred of it had come at great personal risk to him, as well as to the nation. That experience was invaluable. He was invaluable. It pissed Ryan off to see what was happening to him. It wasn't fair, not with everything he had been through, all the scrapes and close calls. This wasn't how a man like Reed Carlton should go out. Yet, it was happening, a little more each day. Ryan had to remind herself that life wasn't fair. Carlton had even told her to get over it. He was still in the fight, and would be until the very end. In the meantime, he didn't want her around if she was going to be morose. They had a tough slog in front of them. If she couldn't be positive and optimistic, he told her, she could stay at the CIA and ride that sick pony into the ground. He had a good sense of humor, and she had grown to love and respect him dearly. She wished they had more time, but the clock was working against them. As he was sharper and more focused first thing in the morning, she had adjusted her schedule to match. Setting her alarm for 4:30, she was able to work out and get to his house by 7. Always, the two dark SUVs of his security team were parked in the driveway. This morning, though, there was a third vehicle, a pearl gray Mercedes van. She rang the doorbell and was greeted by Carlton. He was always showered, shaved, and dressed before she got there. This morning, he was wearing khakis, a green Oxford shirt, and leather driving moccasins.
"Whose van is that outside?" she asked, as they said their good mornings and he let her in.
Gesturing toward his study, he replied, "Nicholas is here." Nicholas was the Carlton Group's IT wizard. He was a Soviet Georgian born with primordial dwarfism. As a result, he stood just under 3 feet tall. He had been abandoned by his parents and raised in a brothel near the Black Sea. The things that had been done to him there were unspeakable. Despite his small stature, his intelligence was off the charts. He had eventually turned snippets of pillow talk and the loose lips of brothel customers into a blackmail empire. He had become known throughout the intelligence world as the Troll. He dealt exclusively in the black market purchase, sale, and theft of highly sensitive, often classified information. Entering the study, the first thing Ryan noticed were Nicholas's giant dogs. Named Argos and Draco, the highly trained, fiercely loyal white Caucasian of Charkas were always at his side. Upon seeing her, the dogs stood up and came over for some attention. She scratched them both behind their ears and ran her hands over their powerful shoulders.
"Me next," said Nicholas with a smile, as he gave the command for the dogs to lie down. "Good morning," she replied with a laugh.
"Coffee?" Carlton asked her. Nicholas already had a cup.
"Yes, please."
It was Harvath who had brought Nicholas into the organization, something that wasn't an easy feat. They had started out as bitter foes, and many in the Carlton group, including Carlton himself, were highly suspicious of Nicholas. But over time, the little man had more than proven his loyalty and his worth. He and Harvath had developed a deep friendship. Though he had been happy for Harvath about his decision to pursue a life and family of his own in Boston, he had been profoundly saddened by his friend's departure. He had been the one person at the Carlton Group whom Nicholas felt he could fully trust.
"I didn't expect to see you this morning," Ryan said to Nicholas. "Something's come up."
Carlton handed her a cup of coffee, and after thanking him, she asked,
"What's going on?" "Late last night," he continued, "a job order was opened on the dark web."
The dark web was a series of encrypted sites,
accessible only through networks using special software, like the Tor Hidden Service Protocol. They allowed users to remain anonymous and beyond the reach of intelligence and law enforcement agencies. From the most abhorrent pornography to the hiring of hitmen, if it was illegal, and especially if it was morally repugnant, it was on the dark web.
What kind of order was it?
A hack, said Nicholas.
Okay, replied Ryan. Of who?
You.
She laughed. As deputy director of the CIA, she was under constant threat of being hacked. In fact, she had stopped paying attention to the reports a while ago. The attacks and scams came daily. That's why the CIA had such a robust IT team, and she trusted them to do their jobs.
So, someone offered a bounty to hack me? What's new?
What's new, replied Nicholas,
is that it was a twofer. The contract was to hack you and Mr. Carlton.
That was new. It also told her that someone suspected they were working together. That had not been announced publicly yet.
What are they looking for?
Everything, replied Nicholas.
Not only all of your previous correspondence, but they wanted code planted that would allow them to monitor everything going forward, undetected.
Do we know who's behind it?
No, said Carlton, and that's the problem. While state actors usually have their own hacking teams in-house, they also have been known to hire criminal hackers.
Whoever this is, said Nicholas, offered up a lot of money for the job.
How'd you find out about it? She asked.
A broker I used to know reached out to one of my old aliases.
Ryan looked at Carlton.
Okay, so someone wants to hack us. It happens to companies every single day. It's probably even going to increase once it gets announced that I've left the agency to come work for you.
True, but this one bothers me. I don't like the timing. I also don't like the amount of resources someone is willing to throw at this. The hack may only be a jumping-off point. I think we need to take this seriously. She didn't disagree.
Okay. What do you suggest?
I think Nicholas should take the job.
She didn't disagree with that either, but the way he let the words hang in the air made her feel that there was another shoe still left to drop.
Then it did. And I think we should let him actually carry out the hack.
Chapter 41. Over the Mediterranean, Tuesday evening. The ramp at the rear of the massive Air Force C-17 Globemaster cracked open, and the last of the setting sun could be seen on the horizon. When a small parachute attached to the rigging on the first high-speed assault craft was released, it began to pull the sleek H-sack down a set of rails running the length of the cargo hold. As the long gray boat was sucked out the back, the SEALs and their boat teams cheered. It never got old throwing huge pieces of equipment out of an airplane thousands of feet in the air. They had lined up single file on either side of the ramp, flippers strapped to their thighs. After the second H-SAC was launched, they began leaping out. The air at 7,000 feet was much cooler than it had been on the ground at U.S. Naval Air Station Sigonella on the island of Sicily. The SEALs and their boat teams were excited to get some action. From what they had heard, the Americans they were going into Libya to exfiltrate had seen some serious fighting. It was the perfect night for a drop. The ocean was warm and calm. It was like landing in a bathtub. As everyone climbed on board, the boat crews cleared the parachutes. Once everyone was accounted for and had taken their places, the crews fired up the powerful diesel engines and headed for the Libyan coast. Back at the safe house, Harvath was on the roof when his satellite phone vibrated. Reading the message, he turned to Barton and said,
"Boats are on their way. 20 minutes out."
After the Reaper had destroyed the militia convoy, Harvath had loaded Haney into the technical and taken off. They were close to the coast. With the help of the drone, they had found an old beach road, which had allowed them to get back to the safe house without being seen. The rest of the team was already there.
The moment he pulled in, they rushed to the truck to help carry Haney inside, where Stalen assessed his injury. Harvath was exhausted and would have killed for some sleep, but he still had work to do, too. Strike Force 2 had dispatched a new, fully fueled, fully armed drone to have on station above their location. It seemed unlikely that the remaining militia members knew who, much less where they were, but it was good to have the extra firepower available just in case. When he stepped into the safe house, the first thing he started working on was how they were going to get out of the country. None of their contingency planning had accounted for taking on the entire Libya Liberation Front. Because the militia controlled this portion of the country and had eyes and ears everywhere, crossing at the border checkpoint into Tunisia was out of the question. So was trying to get out by airplane. They had been lucky just to make it back to the safe house. Going back out on the road would push that luck, probably to the breaking point. You could only kick Murphy in the nuts so many times before he kicked back. That left only one way out, via water. A boat extraction was a possibility he and McGee had discussed. It was an expensive, high-risk last resort, but there were no other options. Things had gotten too hot. Once again, he got on his satellite phone and went directly to the DCI. McGee got the ball rolling right away. When the DCI called back with confirmation, it came with one caveat. Because Haney and Gage were both stable, the powers that be from AFRICOM and the Defense Department wanted to wait until dark. There was no use drawing undue attention by pulling up in broad daylight. Harvath wasn't crazy about waiting, but he understood the reasoning. It was better to wait until dark. With the added peace of mind of having the drone overhead, he assigned a new guard rotation, then went into the kitchen and started some coffee. He wasn't going to feel fully at ease until they had put Libya far behind them. He prepared a quick bite and poured a cup of coffee, hoping it might improve his mood. It didn't. Walking back to the bedroom where Halim as well as the satellite phone salesman were being held, he put his game face on and stepped inside.
"Who dressed his wound?" he asked, pointing at the smuggler's hand as he entered.
Morrison was in charge of watching the two prisoners.
"Stalen did," he replied.
"We're not running a free clinic here," said Harvath as he pulled out his knife.
Walking over to the chair Halim was tied to, he slipped the blade against the man's wrist and drove it down and through his bandages. Whether he had made contact with the injured area, he couldn't tell. What was obvious was how uncomfortable Halim was. As soon as the knife began to move, he winced, and perspiration broke out across his forehead.
"Has he been given any pain meds?"
"Hell no," Morrison answered.
"Good,"
said Harvath, as he began to peel away the bandages. Stalen had done a professional job. In fact, it was too professional. Frustrated, Harvath yanked at the remaining pieces, and the smuggler went into a spasm of pain. Finally, he exposed the severed finger. It looked even worse in the light of day than it had under his night vision goggles.
"Whether you keep this finger or not is up to you. Do you understand me?"
The smuggler nodded. Harvath held up his phone and showed him a university picture of Mustafa Marzouk, the chemistry student who was the owner of the laptop of doom.
"Do you recognize this man?"
The smuggler shook his head.
"Look again,"
he ordered. The man did.
"Well?"
asked Harvath.
"I don't know him,"
the smuggler replied. He was lying. Taking the tip of his knife, Harvath began poking at the exposed wound where his finger was barely attached. Halim screamed in pain.
"Do you recognize this man?"
"Yes, yes, I recognize him,"
he yelled. Harvath forced a smile.
"Now we're getting somewhere. Who is he?"
"I don't know."
He began to bring the knife forward again.
"I don't know his name,"
the smuggler cried.
"I never know the names."
"But you recognize his face?"
The man nodded.
"I can't hear you," said Harvath.
"Yes, I recognize his face."
Harvath set the photo down where Halim could still see it.
You must see hundreds of new people a year, he said. Maybe even thousands. Why would you remember this person?
Because he was a VIP.
Bullshit,
Harvath replied, going back in for the stump.
You're lying.
No, 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 he cried. Not lying. He was a VIP. His organization paid extra.
Paid extra for what? To send him out in a storm and make sure he drowned?
The smuggler lowered his gaze, but Harvath didn't buy his faux remorse for a second.
What did they pay extra for?
For first class.
First class?
Halim looked up at him.
To sit on the top deck, to have food and water, to use the satellite phone if he wished.
But not to have a life jacket,
Harvath stated. The man didn't respond. He simply cast his eyes back down.
Who paid you? What organization?
The smuggler remained silent. Harvath grabbed his arm by the wrist and jammed his knife into the man's stump. Halim screamed and went rigid as the pain exploded throughout his entire body.
Who paid you?
Harvath yelled.
Daesh!
The man cried out, using the Arabic name for ISIS.
Daesh paid me!
Withdrawing the knife, he wiped it on the smuggler's shirt. Halim was on the verge of passing out. Harvath stepped away. Leaning against the wall, he waited for the man to regain his composure. When he felt enough time had passed, he re-engaged.
Why would you send a VIP into a storm like that?
The man was slow to reply, but eventually said,
We thought they could make it.
Bullshit. You sent them out like you always do, in a bad boat without enough fuel.
No,
the smuggler argued.
The boat wasn't the best, but it had extra fuel. We thought they could beat the storm.
And then what? What was the VIP supposed to do then?
Halim didn't want to answer the question. He averted his eyes. Harvath came off the wall, knife in hand.
The Italians would put all of them in a refugee camp, he said, looking up.